computer system does. Let me apologize for that to begin with. Hopefully you won't find it too distracting. If it does, we'll turn it off. You know, I thought a real computer would work, but obviously, in fact, talking to AJ, there seems to be a loose connection somewhere down underneath the floor. So we're not having a blue light, Kmart blue light special here with the flashing light. It's just the way the technology works. And if it does go out completely, let me know, because I can't really see what's going on here. There's the other one. I have a problem with that lip. The lip's a little bit too big, so I'm going to just move my mouse over here so I don't keep banging that, plus the fact that every time I move this a little bit, it seems like it goes out again. So we'll see what happens. Anyways, let me start by making a couple opening comments. This is not going to be a typical message that I'm used to giving, which is some type of teaching lesson. Pastor David, which I thank for giving me the opportunity to speak today, asked me to speak about what God's been doing in my life and sharing some of the things which God has been teaching me through my situation. And it's not going to be easy for me to give this lesson, because it's not what I like to do and not the way my personality is. God created me as a very analytical, logical thinker. I think systematic. I tend to take things to their logical conclusion, which in general makes someone a fairly good teacher. Sharing what God's been working in my life is not easy for me. I'd much rather just give you the facts. John mentioned several times in his preaching, John Moore, for those of you that, you know, he wishes at times he could teach more like myself or Pastor David, where it's more logical and kind of thought through. What I like about John is he teaches with emotion, his passion. You can feel John's passion when he's teaching. And I'm going to try to be like a John today, and that's not going to be easy for me. Hopefully I can get through this. But that's going to be one of my difficulties. The other difficulty that I come to with a fair amount of trepidation and to some degree, I don't know how to really express it, but I'm very conscious of the fact that so far my results with cancer have been much different than many of you. I don't think there's a person in this congregation who hasn't had some loved one who's been touched with cancer. And many of their results have been much different than mine. And therefore, it is somewhat easy, and I have a certain amount of trepidation in just what I'm going to say, that people could easily take the wrong way. And I'll leave it to the grace of God and God to do this. Last thing I want to say before I get started with what I want to share is I couldn't have asked for a better setup for what I am going to say than what John Moore taught back in June. And I hope you all were here with back in June and you can remember what he said. And I thought seriously about just playing his whole message back, because it was such a great setup for me for what I want to share, and just going to 12 o'clock today. And if John Winterstein was still pastor here, I might have been able to get away with that, because he'd go into 11:45 all the time. But Pastor David is real good about being done by 11:30 or before. So I don't want to do that. And this is no reflection on John or John's teaching. But I don't know if all of you remember what John taught. And that was back in June 8th, I believe it was, or thereabouts. But it was about Psalm 130. And frankly, I can go to the store, which is 5 minutes away, that my wife sends me to get something. By the time I get there, I don't know why I'm there, and I have to text her to find out what am I supposed to buy. So if you don't remember John's message, don't feel bad. But John did teach on Psalm 130, and if you remember, it was out of the depths is how that psalm starts. And as John mentioned, what it really says is from the depths. And I'm going to be talking about from the depths, some things that God has put me in the depths and what my reaction was to it. If you look at the screen, if hopefully it doesn't flash off too often on you, the verse from John 17:1, Jesus spoke these things, and lifting up his eyes to heaven, he said, "Father, the hour has come. Glorify your Son, that the Son may glorify you." My question to you is, when did Jesus speak this verse? Anyone know offhand what event immediately preceded these words? No, it was close. John, you said, I think you said it. It's right before the garden. He goes to the Garden of Gethsemane, and right after the Last Supper, Jesus has already completed all the miracles he had done, was going to do, had done, all the mighty things that he showed to demonstrate that he was, in fact, the Son of God, had already been completed. And yet, what does he pray for? That God would glorify the Son. The hour has come. What hour is that? His crucifixion on the cross is the hour he's talking about. And that God would glorify him. I'll state this as much many ways as I can, or as softly as I can, but I believe the Christian church in America today has a very screwed up view of suffering, trials, and tribulations. We don't want them. And yet Jesus prayed that the Father would be glorified through these. Let me share another set of verses from you from Romans. Some very powerful verses. Talking about that battle between the flesh and the spirit. And the fact that as children, we are heirs. Heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ. If indeed we suffer with him, so that we may also be glorified with him. For I consider the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed. If anyone suffered, Paul suffered. He suffered many sufferings. In fact, in Colossians 1:24, Paul says, "Now I rejoice in my sufferings for your sake, and in my flesh I do share on behalf of his body, which is the church, in filling up what is lacking in Christ's affliction." What an honor it is, and what an honor Paul considered, to suffer for Christ's sake, to fill up what is lacking in Christ's suffering. Uh-oh, we're going flashing. Must really want to get this message across. Now we lost it altogether. Maybe it'll come back, maybe it won't. Well, anyways, if you can't see it, hopefully I can read you through it. Hopefully it's not driving you nuts. It's driving me nuts right now. Because my screen's flashing all over the place. I don't know what your screen's doing. That's good. If it stays black, it's better than nothing. Anyways, suffering is something that, in some ways, we should look forward to. And that's basically my message in a nutshell. So let me this statement, which I have made many times, I think is why Pastor David asked me to speak today. Cancer has been the greatest blessing to me, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. I guess you can't see it, so that's what the statement is supposed to say right now. Cancer has been a great blessing to me, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. And I'm sure you're saying, besides the fact that the guy's nuts, and Susie would be glad to confirm that for you, why? Why do I consider cancer to be the a blessing and something I wouldn't trade? Well, that's what I'm going to share with you, what God has been doing in my life as a result of that. In order to put some context to this, though, I want to cover three things first as a way of putting that in context. First of all, how God found me. Secondly, a little bit about my struggle with cancer, so you know. So many of you know who I am, and you know pretty much my history, but there are some people who don't know me from Adam, and therefore, just to put some context. And lastly, I want to really answer the question, why? What has God been teaching me? Why do I consider my cancer to be a blessing? Now we got it. So who knows? It'll come and go. Let me, again, if it gets really distracting, let me know. We'll just turn it off altogether. So let me start with how God found me to begin with. I can guarantee to you that I was not looking for God. There was no interest in God whatsoever when God found me. Oh, it's gone again. Anyways, you want me to cut it off? It's too distracting. Is that okay? Driving you nuts. Let me turn this thing off. We'll have to get this fixed somehow or other. Hopefully, I can keep track of where I'm going, even if you don't know where I've been. I wasn't looking for God. In fact, I was one of these ignorant fools who said I'd rather be in hell with my friends than in heaven with the do-gooders. And that's what I considered all of you sitting out there. At least I assume most of you are do-gooders. And I say that's I was an ignorant fool because I had no concept of what hell is. And I can guarantee you people aren't going to be partying in hell with their friends. In fact, what does Jesus generally compare when he talks about good and evil, and he talks about being saved and unsaved? He often used the analogy of light, in the light or in the darkness. I'm fairly sure that people in hell are going to be in utter darkness. That's what they wanted. He even said they desire to be in the dark. They're going to get it, I believe. Hell is not going to be a place where you talk to your friends. I'm going to talk about heaven a little bit later on, too. It's not going to be a time of partying. It's going to be a time of solitary confinement. Utter darkness. That's what I think hell is going to be to a large degree. What does the word death actually mean? Separation. You're separated. You're in isolation. You're not going to be there partying with your friends. I was an ignorant fool and didn't know it, which is a whole other issue. In my youth, I attended a liberal mainline church that taught what most churches, a lot of these churches today teach. It gave, Jesus was just a good moral teacher, and you get to heaven by doing more good than bad. And as long as you can do more good than bad, you'll be all right. And that's more or less what I was taught. We happened to attend a United Methodist church. It was right down the street from where I lived, and the pastor, and in high school, I worked as a soda jerk in a pharmacy, a local pharmacy, and the local pastor of that United Methodist Church used to come in all the time to talk in the evenings. And as we discussed religion and what he taught, that if you do more good than bad, you're going to go to heaven, my question to him, every time we had a discussion, well, what makes Christianity any different from Islam or Judaism or Buddhism or any other religion you want to name? If doing more good than bad is how you get to heaven, why be a Christian? What's the difference? And he couldn't answer that. And therefore, when I graduated from high school, I considered myself to be an agnostic. You couldn't know about God. I mean, I believe at that point there was a God, but you couldn't know about him. I went to college to become a game biologist. That was my goal. I went to the College of Environmental Science and Forestry at Syracuse University, and I was hoping to become a game biologist when I graduated. I ended up in botany rather than zoology, animals, but I graduated from Syracuse, and as a result of my education, I had over 100 credit hours in biological sciences as part of my degree, and I graduated, which included evolution, several semesters of evolution to be exact, and I could tell you the process of evolution from the chemical process all the way through to evolution of man. And I graduated from college as an atheist and a evolutionist, and the two go hand in hand. If you understand evolution, and you really understand, and most people who believe in it have no concept of what it really is, you also become, especially if you're a logical thinker who thinks things back to the logical conclusion, you have to become an atheist. And it also creates tremendous moral conflict in you. at least if you have any morals at all, which I did. While I wasn't a religious family growing up, I was a moral family. My mom grew up Catholic, attended Catholic school, and I had morality down. And if you believe in evolution, then you naturally have a tremendous moral conflict, because evolution, if it's taking place, then man is only at the top of the heap as long as he uses his advantages to stay at the top of the heap. It's survival of the fittest. You've got to use your advantages. And that means you have to kill off and eliminate all the weak genes in your gene pool. You have to destroy or kill, keep from reproducing the infirm, the handicapped, the mentally deficient. I mean, that you have to do that. If you don't do that, you're not going to stay at the top of the heap. And when I graduated from college, I expected the insects at one point to take over the world. Because there's a famous person who said the world has 12 years left to exist. I can remember writing a letter home to my mom in high school, or at the end of my college career, where I told her we had 15 years. I was a little bit more optimistic than the 12 years they're giving today. But that's where I was when I graduated from college, an atheist and an evolutionist. I got a job at the Lancaster County Park System, and fortunately God was working in my life. Even at that point, I broke my ankle one day in the job, and that led to me being hired as the county park naturalist and starting the nature program at Lancaster County Park. And I was a park naturalist. That doesn't mean I was walking around with no clothes on. That means I was giving environmental education. You have to watch the word naturalist today, because people have a different term for that than originally was defined. But anyways, I was working at the park, and I got hired as a park naturalist as a result of fortunately breaking my ankle one day when I was working. Led me to being in the park office, where we had a park secretary who was a believer. And she was taking, and we were in the middle of nowhere in the park office, so there was nothing to do, no place you could go. We had a half hour for lunch, there was no place you could go for lunch, so we ate we usually ate sitting out on a picnic bench outside the park office. That was the only place really, you had to carry your lunch and eat there because you didn't have time to go anyplace else. It was too far. You didn't have enough time. So I used to sit at, we used to eat together at lunch a lot of times and talk about stuff. And she was taking this Bill Gothard seminar at the time up at Hershey. I mean, some of you are young enough to remember these Bill Gothard seminars. They used to travel all over the country giving seminars on things. And this one in particular had to do with interpersonal relationships. And she was taking this course. And at the time, I was involved in a very ugly situation at the park, because I had two people above me, a park director and a park superintendent, who hated each other and were doing everything they could to get the other guy fired. So I was dealing with these interpersonal relationships, and here she was taking this course in interpersonal relationships as part of this Bill Gothard thing. And I thought the Bible was a bunch of, BS. So I set out to prove to her that this stuff was foolishness and was, should never, you're going down the wrong way to solve things. And in the process, I actually taught or proved to myself that the Bible couldn't have been written by men. It had to be written by a higher force or power. That by itself didn't do anything other than change my opinion of the Bible. It was 4 months later, after that God put me in a situation where everything was just dark, and it was almost hopeless. If you believe in evolution and there is no God, you're just there by blind random chance, waiting to become a bunch of dust. That's all there is for the future and all there is for hope. And this job, which I liked, I'm caught between two people who hate each other, and anything I do is going to get the other guy mad at me. I mean, it doesn't matter day by day, I got to side with one or the other, and every time I side with one, I'm the enemy of the other. I had a county commissioner who used to call me every night to want me to spy on my boss. It just was an ugly situation. I hated what was going on in my life, and there was no place else to go. So what did I do? Well, I had proved, I've come to the conclusion that the Bible was had to be written by something higher, a higher power than man. So I grabbed my Bible, I opened it up, and lo and behold, I opened it up to Romans, the book of Romans. Why the book of Romans? You ask God when you get to heaven if you want to know the answer, because I don't. I picked the book of Romans. I didn't know anything about the Bible. I didn't know squat. Picked the book of Romans and read the first five chapters. And while reading those five chapters, God opened up my mind to believe and understand his plan of salvation. You know, if you're going to lead someone to Christ, how do you do it? What's one of the most famous ways? The Roman road. Well, I read it without even knowing I was reading it or why I was reading it, but that's what happened. And as a result of that, I came to know Jesus Christ as my Savior. It was God working in me while I was trying to run away from him. But that's my story of salvation. Let me tell you a little, just a brief overview of my struggle with cancer. In July of 2013, it was the first time I suspected something was wrong with me. I started having blood in my urine. Of course, being a man and being self-reliant like I am, I didn't tell my wife for 6 months, so it wasn't until January of 2014 that I was actually diagnosed with bladder cancer. I went through basically a year and a half of various tests and treatments and stuff like that, and finally it was decided in August of 2015 that I needed to have surgery to remove the bladder because the treatments were not going to eliminate the cancer by themselves. So I had neobladder surgery where they actually take a section of your intestine out, they cut a section of that out, they reform it into a bladder, they cut out your bladder and put in a new, put the section of your intestines where the bladder used to be. And it's an unbelievable process. I don't know, it was like 10-hour surgery. It's crazy. Whoever thought of it, I don't know. But I will tell you, the bladder they put in there works nowhere like the bladder that God gave you. And it's better than the alternative, but it's nowhere near what God's bladder was like. That's some of the consequences thereafter. What I didn't know at the time when I had this, well, I guess I was so out of it with the role of that surgery, I didn't know a lot of stuff. During that surgery, I was supposed to be in 3 to 5 days in the hospital. I ended up being in 23 days. Without the intervention of my wife, I probably could have died twice during that 23 days. Being a former nurse, she was on top of some things and made some things happen. And at one point, Joe Horst, who some of you know, who used to attend here just like Ellie, Bill and well, Deb's back there. I guess that would be your cousin, right? Yeah, I woke up and here I am in intensive care, waking up more out of it than I'm in it, and there's Joe as my nurse, you know, and they convinced the doctor to do something that he wouldn't want to do between my wife and Joe. Anyways, I survived that, but one of the things that was told to Susie at that point that they told me, I didn't know it, or I didn't realize what they were saying, I was so out of it at the time, is when they got in there and took out my bladder, they found that the cancer was much more pervasive than they thought. It had already grown out of the bladder and into the muscle. So they not only had to take out the bladder, but they also had to take out a whole bunch of my stomach muscles. And that meant that the cancer was already spreading. And typical lifespan for someone who has, once the cancer gets out, is 2 years. And they told my wife that. I didn't realize that. But I was getting tested all along. Well, 2.5 years later, it reappears in my liver. And that was last February of 2018, I find out that the cancer is in my liver. And the urologist who was dealing with me up to that point, he now washes his hands and turns me over to the oncologist. And one thing I'll tell you about oncologists, they don't screw around. I walk into the room, and other than saying hello, she said, you got less than 2 years to live. Boom, just like that. Hit me out of the blue. There wasn't any, I guess oncologists are used to dealing with death and urologists aren't, but man, she didn't mess around. Boom, there she is. She hit me with it. So I find out that I'm going to die. And I probably should have known that earlier, but I didn't because I didn't really catch what was going on when I had my neobladder surgery. They start these treatments, this new treatment that wasn't available the first time I was being treated, called immunotherapy. Is that right? Yeah, immunotherapy stuff. And meanwhile, I'm expecting to die. I expect to be dead by this time when they told me that last year. So we got to make plans to get out of our house and move and do all this stuff that you have to do. So we're doing all that, and I basically have reconciled myself to the fact that I'm dying and I'm going to be dead. I'm going through the immunotherapy, and about this time last year, in the middle of July, we had our first set of scans, and lo and behold, the tumor's shrinking. To be quite honest with you, there was a lot of profound disappointment at that point. I had reconciled myself that I was going home to be with the Lord, and I was ready. A lot of you are my age. You got the aches and the pains. I was going to go home and see Jesus, free of everything that's gone on. I was ready, frankly. And all of a sudden they tell me, you may not be going home to see Jesus. You may be here longer. I was disappointed, profoundly disappointed at first, because it was already settled in my mind what was going to happen. And I want to deal with one thing that people have said about that. I've been politely or gently suggested several times the fact that I was disappointed. Well, aren't you being selfish? They said it in one way or the other. Aren't you being selfish about this? Yes, it's good for you, but what about Susie? What about Joel? What about all your friends? Let me ask you a couple questions about that. Is God in control? Is He sovereign and control? Is Romans 8:28 true? He works all things together for those who are called. Is He working all things together? Now, because of last week, you couldn't turn on TV or couldn't listen to stuff where you didn't hear something about the moon landing. What a fantastic event that was. Sending men to the moon and back. The 50th anniversary was all over the place. And we marvel at that. This iPhone that I have, speaking of that, you realize that this little device is so many times more powerful than the computers that were used to send that man to the moon and back, that this device by itself could send 120 million rockets at the same time to the moon and back. It has more power than the computers that sent those people to the moon and back. And then the computers that sent people to the moon and back were as big as a woman's classroom. I mean, it took the whole woman's classroom just to put those computers in, and that sent one rocket to the moon and back. This thing can send 120 million. And we marvel at some of the things that man has done or can create. Unless you have a Samsung phone, of course, then you marvel that it didn't burn up in your pocket. Right, Jerry? I had to put that cut in for Jerry. I was disappointed at one point because I didn't see Jerry here, and I had this line all lined up for him, just for Jerry. He's my fishing buddy. And it wouldn't be a normal day if I didn't get a cut in on Jerry. He gets his shots back, don't worry. He always catches the fish and I don't, so that's all he has to do. Anyways, getting back to the thing, you want to marvel at something? Think about just the people in this room. All of us, I'm going to make the assumption all of us are believers in Jesus Christ. We have hundreds of interactions with each other and others. God, before the foundation of the world, developed a plan, including all of us, that everything we do works together for good. Think about that. Think about all the interconnections that have to happen and all the things that God's working, and everything for every one of us works together for good. There's going to be some suffering in that. There's going to be some bad things. We're going to make some failures and we're going to sin. All that was included in that plan. And he works all of it together for good. That's something to be amazed at. What man has done and what man can do pales in comparison. There's no, you can't compare it. It's not on the same level. And that's something to really amaze. So going back, is it selfish of me? I think it's just the opposite. It's arrogant of me to think that God needs me. He doesn't need me. If he takes me home to be with the Lord, which he could do before I get hit by a bus this afternoon, we don't need cancer to do that. That's what Susie and Joel and all of you need. He has a plan. He's carrying it out. And whatever happens in that plan is for your good. And that may be or may not be involved someone being taken home through the Lord early. But it's for your good. And he's going to teach you through it. And that's the amazing thing to me about the way God works. I don't have to worry about you anymore, do I? I keep worrying about whether you can see what I'm seeing. Now I can't get my mouse to move. So anyways, that's kind of my fight with cancer. Now I get backed up a couple times, apparently, so I got to get through some stuff so I know where I'm at, because I don't know where I'm at half the time anyways. So the cancer did obviously end up treatments. I had another round of treatments. They kept working. They shrunk the cancer to the point that it actually was, I was able to have laparoscopic surgery last October, and they removed the tumor. And at this point, to the amazement of the whole medical community, I'm tumor-free of cancer. I get scanned every 3 months, and at any point I could find out again that I have cancer. But at this point, I'm tumor-free, and the liver doctor who did the surgery, he refers to me as the outlier, because I'm so far outside the bell curve for cancer, having survived now almost 5 years, that it's not worthwhile talking about. Theoretically, I should have died a long time ago. So let me talk about some things that God has taught me through this and why I consider it such a great blessing. First and foremost, and this really goes back to my first neobladder surgery when I was in the hospital for 23 days, God taught me the value of prayer and fellowship, Christian fellowship. I come from the school of rugged individualism. You know, I don't need anybody. I don't need any help. I can do it myself. Before my neobladder surgery, if I prayed 10 minutes, it was a good day. I didn't need to pray for you, and I didn't need you to pray for me. I was absolutely blown away by people praying for me during this surgery. You know, and I was pretty helpless for quite a while. I got a lot to thank my wife for taking care of me and putting up with me during that time. But any case, I realized for the first time how valuable prayer was. I was blown away by the people that told me they were praying for me. People all over this country, not just here. Indiana, Arizona, you name the state, someone came up, talked to me about how we've been praying for you. All of you praying for me and all of you dropping in. And I don't mention any names here because if I did, I forget somebody. Even this morning, there's at least 7 or 8 people who told me they've been praying for me to give this message today. You know, it just blows me away. And for the first time, I realized the value of Christian prayer and fellowship and how much I needed you. And to some degree, how much you need me and what I can contribute. You know, it's a mutual thing, as the scriptures clearly taught. And I can't thank the Lord enough for teaching me that. Before my neoblast surgery, again, I prayed 10 minutes at most. It was a good day if I got 10 minutes of prayer in. And it was mainly, what can you do for me today, God? Now it's rare if I don't spend at least 45 minutes or an hour in prayer every morning. He's changed my whole life on that. A second thing that God has shown me, he actually made me, you know, I laid in bed, even after I got out of the surgery and got out of the hospital, I had this problem with my hips that I couldn't really move. I was like paralyzed for another 6 weeks. I could only move by rocking back and forth. You want to talk about rugged individualism, not being able, needing help of someone else. For roughly 4 or 5 weeks, I couldn't even put on my own underwear without the help of my wife or someone, one of the nurses. Couldn't take a shower. I couldn't get in and out of the shower without someone helping me. I mean, you talk about being stripped down to nothing. I was stripped down. And I had a lot of time to think. And you start thinking about the really being the type of thinker I am, where I go back to the logical things. You start thinking about the real important things. Why was man created? What's man's purpose? Let me just deal with a couple of those things and some of the things that God taught me about this. Why was man created? You know, if you go back to the very beginning, Genesis, you know, one of the things God did with Adam and Eve is walk with them in the cool of the evening. Think about that. The God of the universe. I mean, most of us would give our right arm to be able to meet the president or meet some famous person. Adam and Eve, and we were designed to walk in the cool of the evening with the God who created this universe. If you haven't thought about how magnificent this universe is, you need to think about it. Unbelievable what this universe is like. And we were designed, or we were created to walk with Him. But more importantly than that, Revelation tells us that we were created to glorify God. That's our ultimate purpose, to glorify God. What a tremendous thing. In fact, and this is something, again, that God has really brought home to me in the last couple months. Anything that we do that we don't do for the glory of God is sin. I don't care how good man looks at it and says it. If I help some old woman across the street and it wasn't done for the glory of God, what is it? It's filthy rags. It's my own righteousness. Frankly, if I really think about it, most of what I do is for the glory of Al. Most of what I do, what you would call good, is for the glory of Al. It's sin. It's filthy rags. That's what it is. We do so little, frankly, I think, that's really for the glory of God. And that's why we were created, to glorify God. And God has really driven that home to me, that just thinking about why am I here? What's my purpose? It's so easy to get stuck on that. It's also so easy. I started thinking about what's really important in life. And it's one of the things that helped us, especially last year when I was told I had less than 2 years to live. At the same time, you know, we're getting ready to move because there's no way Susie can take care of the property we currently live on, and we're getting rid of the stuff, you know, and the kids don't want anything that you have. I don't know if any of you are old enough to ask your kids if you want anything, but the answer is no, they don't want it. What do I do with all this junk? I spent my whole life working to accumulate all this stuff, and now the only thing I have left to do with it is take it to Farmersville and get pennies on the dollar, or just plain throw it out. I'm looking there at all these things on my bookshelf, different awards and stuff I've won over the years. What's going to happen to them? They're gone in the trash can. What's really important in life? You know, really drive home that thing when you realize that what I've worked for all my life all of a sudden has no value. Another question that often came up in my thinking is, what's heaven going to be like? And it's interesting because right before I got told I was, you know, I'm going to die, I started this lesson in Sunday school about every time in the Bible, starting in Genesis and going through Revelation, that man was confronted by God or was taken to heaven or saw something to do with heaven. I'm doing this study at the same time I've been told I'm going there. So it's kind of neat the way God worked the two things together. But in any case, you know, I don't know if you've thought much about heaven, but I have, because I thought I was going there. And I realized my thinking about heaven is all wrong. Heaven is not, you know, I had a very similar view of heaven in some ways like I had of hell, except we're going to go to heaven and we're all going to talk about all the things we did here on the earth. That was my view of heaven. Now, I tell you what, based on what I've been studying and what God has revealed to me, heaven is not going to be about all the things that I did and what we did here on earth. We're not going to sit around talking about each other. We're going to be talking about what God did. It's going to be all about God. That God has shown me that so clearly. We're going to be there seeing and talking about all that God has done. Probably the if I could sum up this, and I see that I'm out of my time, so I'm going to sum it up. If I had to sum up everything that God has been teaching me, it's basically that everything that we're doing is about God. It's not about me. It is so easy to make life about me. It's not about me. It's about God. And in heaven, I'm convinced the only thing we're going to talk about is what God did to us, what God is doing in our life. And just think about spending all day, every day, learning more about the God of creation, all that He did, all that He is. It's going to be total joy, not because if we're going to sit around like it's a big old neighborhood party where we talk about all that we did on earth. You know, I've often thought, you know, I've got to finally get the answer to this question. You know, I don't think I'm going to get the answer to any of those questions. I'm going to get the answer to who God is and what He's all about. So I'll sum it up with that because I don't want to go real long. I'll get in trouble with you now that John Winterstein's no longer here to go until 11:45. I don't want to go to 11:45 either. So I'll close in a word of prayer, and I hope this has been of some value to me. I know I've taught so much, and again, suffering in our life, and I did have up here in the show, James, as a reminder, James 2, I think it's 2 through 4, count it all joy when you fall into trials and tribulations. What God is doing right now is conforming us into the image of His Son. And there's only one way to get there. Trials and tribulations. Some of us are more stubborn than others, and we need more of a knock in the head than others. That would be me. And therefore, some suffering may be worse than others. But if you're serious about your relationship with Jesus Christ, you're going to go through sufferings. And it's the only way to get from here to there is through suffering and failure. Nature is so corrupted. It's the only way we can get there. So let me close in prayer, and we'll go from there. Our Father, I thank You for this time, chance to share. We pray that Your Spirit might be our guide and our teacher. We thank You that we have such a magnificent God who has planned and carrying out His plan that He designed before the foundation of the world, and all things are working together for our good, that He who began a good work in us will complete it to the day of Christ Jesus. And we thank You for these things and ask for Your safety as we travel home. In Your name we pray. Amen.